subject of the talk today is really looking at devices that we have available to provide the boundary conditions that we need for flow experiments. And not news to any of you, we have two types of boundary conditions that we're interested in applying, either constant head boundary conditions or constant flux boundary conditions, as soil physicists. These are water flow boundary conditions, obviously. And ideally, we want to be able to apply these both at the inflow and outflow end, say, of a column or a field apparatus. So today I'm going to look at four methods, I think three of which are very familiar to you and one which probably isn't familiar to you, and kind of judge them on the basis of what they can provide. So to start very simple, we're just going to look at a bucket. So if we have a bucket and it has an air-water interface, the pressure of the water at that surface is going to be zero. As water flows out of this bucket, obviously the water level drops, total head in the bucket drops, and that results in a change in both the head, the total head, and also a change in the rate of flux. So in terms of our table then, a bucket is almost a complete failure. It can't provide these constant inflow boundary conditions that we want. I don't discuss why, but I think it's probably obvious that it can't provide a constant flux outflow. The only thing that it can provide is a constant head outflow, if say you connect the tube to the outflow end, and then let the bucket overflow. So at that point, it will maintain a constant outflow head, and that brings us to our second device, which is an overflow device. The first reference that I've seen to this, an overflow device, was this H.F. Pierce in 1923. And essentially it's a bucket, but it's a bucket that you keep adding fluid to in excess. And because you're adding fluid in excess, you maintain this constant head inside the bucket, and therefore you maintain a constant outflow. Again, if you connected a tube to the outflow end of this, it would also work as an overflow device and maintain a constant head on the outflow as well. So this simple overflow device is actually very successful in supplying the boundary conditions that we want. And the only problem with this device is that you have to keep adding fluid in excess. So it's not very convenient for longer term experiments or standalone or field experiments, things like that. So that brings us to the third device. The subject of the talk, in a sense, is the Mariette bottle. It was the brainchild of Edme Mariette, who lived in Dijon about 150 years before Darcy, just to give us some historical relevance. He's credited with two discoveries. First, of course, the Mariette bottle, and the second is the blind spot where the optic nerve comes into the back of the eye. So obviously he had a broad interest in his research career. And I don't know if this, Jean, you can tell me if this applies in Quebec, but in France he's also credited with discovering Boyle's Law, which he discovered independently and published 7 years after Boyle. And it has obviously some relevance to the Mariette bottle. So a Mariette bottle, probably everybody in the room knows this, but I'll go through the operation of a Mariette bottle. It begins its life as a bucket, and then you put a lid on the bucket. It has two tubes, one that terminates above the air-water interface outside the bucket and one that terminates below the air-water interface. So that terminates below, you start a siphon. It starts acting as a siphon. Water flows out. As the water flows out, the water level on the inside drops, increasing the volume of the air headspace but not adding any air molecules, so the pressure decreases, right? So the time with Boyle's Law. This continues until the water pressure at the inlet end of the, outlet end of the air tube becomes zero. Any further decrease in pressure causes air to bubble in, increasing the number of gas molecules. So you maintain roughly a constant pressure at the water table at the inlet end of the air hose. And then this height difference between the outlet of the siphon and the inlet of the air hose provides your constant head and therefore your constant flux condition. So it's an elegant solution because there are no moving parts. It's no power. It works on its own for long periods of time. And because of that, we see it in all sorts of devices in soil physics. Single ring, double ring infiltrometers. It's integrated into disc infiltrometers and borehole permeameters or the amusimeter to tie it into art session. It's also used in more sophisticated devices, so it's shown here in a chromatograph, I think, and it's also probably most widely used in less sophisticated devices, even though we may not recognize it as such. But despite all of this, the Mariette bottle still does have two pretty major limitations. And the first is that it only works as long as the fluid level is above the base of the air tube. And after that point, it reverts to a bucket again. So it starts acting just as a bucket. The second is that you can't reverse the direction of flow. So you can't take the tube and put it on the water outflow. It won't maintain a constant outflow head, until the water starts flowing out of the top of the air tube. So because of that, the Mary bottle essentially is really limited only to an inflow device. It can't provide any of the outflow characteristics that we want. But it does have some advantages over the overflow device and not needing constant supply of fluid. So what else is left? Oh, yeah, that's probably for you too, Jean. I don't know where that little fleur-de-lis came from. Somewhat appropriate. The whales apparatus is another alternative, and it's one that I think is probably widely forgotten, if not completely forgotten. And I'll present this in terms of a review of this extremely brief debate that took place in science in 1934. That's when J.H. Wales first proposed this device. It's also a very elegant, simple little device, and it's based on the use of a siphon as well, and its purpose was to provide a constant flow of liquids. The idea basically is that there's a floating siphon. So this siphon has a tube that comes up and falls below the fluid level. It maintains this constant height difference between the inlet and outlet of the siphon. So no matter what the level of the fluid is, there's a constant head drop across the siphon, so you produce a constant flow. Of course, in reference to this in the next issue of Science, and all of these are the actual images from Science at that time, very different magazine than today. E.L. McCarthy pointed out with his version of a Marriott bottle that there already existed something that could do exactly what Wales was purporting to do. It was interesting, McCarthy didn't provide any reference for the Marriott bottle, so it almost infers that it was not widely known or widely used, perhaps. This W.A. McCubbin had joined in on the dog pile and just said, without any proof or any discussion, that Wales' apparatus was too complex and it just wouldn't work. And then finally, Pierce jumped in and reminded readers of the overflow device that he had designed some, I think, 11 years previously. And after that, there was essentially absolutely nothing. There was no further discussion. It didn't follow that thread or at all. It just dropped. And this, despite the fact that Marriott bottles and overflow devices, you see them all the time, and this Wales device is essentially forgotten. Now, there's a good reason that it's forgotten, and that's because it's overcomplex and it doesn't work. The problem is that there's a practical problem, which is this floating siphon, which is kind of, you can imagine, difficult to deal with. It's a little bit unwieldy. And the other has to do with this, the use, as you can see from Wales's figure, of the same fluid on the inside and outside of the bucket. And you can see that because the fluid level is the same. So if you think about it for a minute, if you ignore the density of the container itself, this is essentially identical to just a bucket. So the Wales device kind of reduces to a bucket with a floating siphon in it, which can provide a constant inflow condition, but because that water level in the bucket continues to drop, it doesn't provide a constant head inflow, and it can't provide constant outflow conditions. So we, kind of along a separate path, but it makes a better story to say that we decided to try to modify the Wales apparatus, and we did it by looking at this idea of needing to maintain the same fluid in both buckets. So if we walk through this for a minute, if you imagine that you had a more dense fluid in the inner bucket than the outer bucket, and what happens is as you take water out of the inner bucket, that fluid level drops, but then that entire container now weighs less. So that entire container is going to float higher in the outer container. And if you match these properly, then the absolute level of that inner fluid stays the same, even though you're taking water out of the inner container. And to do this, you essentially have to match the cross-sectional areas of the two buckets and the densities of the two fluids. And this is just a simple relationship that describes that matching. And if you look at this, some things come out that maybe are obvious in retrospect. If the densities are the same, or if it's the same fluid, then the outer container has to be infinite. So in other words, if you're taking water out of the ocean, you're not really changing its fluid level. And then also, if we accept that the outer bucket has to be larger than the inner, and that all densities are positive, then you find that this can only work if the inner fluid is more dense than the outer fluid. One of the advantages to this is that you no longer need a floating siphon. So you can actually fix a siphon to the side of this. So you get rid of the problem of the floating siphon that was in the Wales apparatus. And when you do this, and I should have mentioned that you can also then add or subtract fluid from that inner vessel, and it will act the same way. So because of that, then this, like the overflow bottle, can provide constant head inflow, constant flux inflow, and constant head outflow conditions. And it also has some advantages and disadvantages. We sort of think of it as falling somewhere between maybe the Marriott bottle and the overflow bottle. The last thing to show, we'll wish for the best on this, is that this outer container doesn't have to be a continuous outer container. As long as the total cross-sectional area of the containers satisfies that AO condition, it can be a series of containers that are hydraulically connected to one another. All right, so let's hope that this next thing is going to work. This, what follows, may be one of the least interesting movies you'll ever see, but it's an actual modified Wales apparatus in progress. And the things to watch are this fluid level. As it starts to operate, this blue fluid is going to come up into this tube. The bottom of this should move up, and that should stay steady as long as the movie actually runs, which, of course, it's not going to, which removes every last bit of drama that might have been building. So, but we do have this inset, this lovely inset, which shows that, and this is the operation of one of these bottles. We basically measured the anonymous time on this axis and the anonymous volume on this axis, and we showed the time that it took for each volume of fluid to flow out of this system, and then this is the point here at which we refill the bottle. And so we can see that we get constant flow through the operation of the device, even when we're refilling the bottle. Let's see if we do that, what happens. Yep. All right, so again, imagine this going up, this going down, this going up, everyone saying ooh, and that's the end of the presentation. So thank you very much. I would get it larger. Oh, yeah, actually, Art will be happy to know this probably happened because I did this on a Mac. That's probably the problem. Anyway, I don't know if we have time for questions. Be happy to try to address a question.
Okay, thank you very much. And, Ilka?
I suggest that you take 5-minute break and then you can start the business meeting. Okay, so I'll put here in the back the Thank you.
You?
Yeah. That doesn't matter.
Do you want to put copies down? I put it in the back, actually, but...
I don't mind that.
Sure, yeah. Say, Jerka, one other thing. When are you coming back in Riverside? Tomorrow?
Tomorrow evening, late evening, 8 o'clock or something.
Because I need to practice with the new Hydrus.
And you're leaving today, so send email to Mirek then, if you need it before tomorrow evening.
The two codes, yeah. Mirek, okay.
And otherwise
and download from the website, right? Because there's a new version.
Yeah, and okay. Otherwise I'll give it on Friday only, right? Okay.
Being going to be around because my wife likes to have a photo of the real. So I have to bring the digital camera. So many things take photos. Are you able to see?
Yeah.
Make sure you do that one.
You send me the...
Can you do the electronic?
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay, so please let me start the meeting so it's over roughly quickly. Okay, so welcome to this S1 business meeting. I hope that you are enjoying the program so far. Obviously, you can criticize me for how it is organized, but not for the content, because you are providing the content. This is the program, so introductory remark, that's what I'm doing now. Then I will introduce the division officers, candidates for the incoming chair-elect. Then we need to improve minutes from the last meeting. We will recognize the awardees. at this meeting, and then there will be some additional business announcement and so on. So first of all, the division officers. So past chair is John Wright, and he's here, right, somewhere? I don't see him, but... chair-elect is Per Moldrap, he's here, so he will be doing what I'm doing now, next year. Then you elected Jakub Paczewski to be the incoming chair. David Radcliffe is in his first year, I think, as the board representative, and he will be serving in that another 2 years. And then it's Bob Horton, who is our S1 representative on SSSARA response team. And he's over there.
Okay, so the
first announcement which I have is that the candidates for the incoming chair-elect for our division are Ty Frey. Is Ty here? Ty Frey and Yan Jin. And she's there. And so I think early spring are the elections, right? So these are your two candidates. Do you want to say any what kind of program you have? Or okay, and in the back of the room, I gave you the minutes from the last meeting, and we do need to approve those. And so did you have a chance to look at them, and do you is there a motion to approve them? Come on, someone has to come up with a motion. Okay. So any discussion on the minutes? Okay, so then let's vote on it. So who agrees with the minutes, to approve the minutes? Okay, thank you. Who is against? Anybody abstain?
Okay, that's it. Okay, well, we usually also have this in memoriam, and I contacted people and asked whether there was anybody who passed away in the last year, and I didn't get any name, and I realized that Tanji actually died last year.
So let's take a 1 minute acknowledgement of that. Okay, thank you. And another point I have here is, as you probably remember, last year, just before the meeting, Ole Jacobsen had a brain surgery. And so I was asking Per Moldrap to give up some update on his status.
As you may remember from last year, I told you that Ole Jacobsen, that many of you know, suffered from a bleeding in the interior brain and serious stroke. He's partly on his way to recovery. He cannot talk yet, but he can say a few words. He cannot write, but he can copy and paste. So if you want to, I mean it, this is really something that can help here. And if you want to, I would greatly appreciate those of you that knows Ole. Please consider contacting him. Contact me down at the poster session after the S1 business meeting, and I'd be glad to tell a little bit more about Ole's condition and help you contact him. I think that the plan is at Aarhus University, where he is working there, trying to see if he can lift a part time job when we move a little bit forward in the process. And again, I hope that he'll recover to some extent, and I really hope that we'll see him one day here at the meetings again. But the last thing I want to say, I've seen how his colleagues at Aarhus University has supported him and been there for him for the last year, and I think they really, really did an excellent job, supported him so much, so I was really grateful for that, and thank you to those guys. Several of them are participating here in the meetings this year. So please contact me at the poster session if you want to hear a little bit more about Ole and maybe also want to contact him. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, and then the next point is to recognize our award recipients. So that's obviously a great pleasure always. So our highest award, which I guess we have in S1, is Don and Betty Kirkham Soul Physics Award, and Jakub Paczewski is the recipient of that award. So Jakub was very successful as a student. Jakub was very successful, as you see. You elected him not only to be your next chair, but also got this very prestigious award. The second very large award is the Carl Sprengel Agronomic Research Award, which was awarded to Mary Beth Kirkham. And she's back in the room. Then I found two awards, which I thought are can be associated with our division, but I actually don't know if these two people are from our division. If Heilong Wang, are you aware of that, that he would be somehow associated with our division, or Bruno Bossel? Okay. Then another large award was the Soil Science Distinguished Service Award to Keith Castle. You see here? He's not here. And then there were three SSSA fellows, Bob Bauman, Sally Loxdon, and Glenn Wilson. And Glenn is here, Sally is probably somewhere in the back, right? Oh, so please recognize them. And last, two ASA fellow, John Wright and Teferi Sekai. And John, I'm sure, is here, so please. And after this business meeting is over, there is an ASA award reception, so you can go there, or you can go to our poster session, which I would recommend you more. Okay, and next point on our agenda is to present an S1 Early Career Award, and that will be done by Ty Frey.
I'd like to first of all thank all of the committee for participating in the selection. It was an incredibly difficult selection this year. We had some fantastic candidates, and I think that the only thing that they definitely had in common was that all of us that have won this in past years were happy that we weren't competing against any of these folks, or we wouldn't have this award. The award this year is going to be presented to Jasper Vroet. Jasper was born in the Netherlands, did his undergraduate and at University of Amsterdam, also his master's and PhD. He worked with Willem Boudin there. He first published in 2001, right? 2001. He has, at this point, 31 publications in things ranging from Water Resources Research, Phytozone Journal, Proceedings in the National Academy of Sciences, Geophysical Research Letters, and Avian Biology. So his work is expansive and extremely highly cited. One of the things that I did when I was looking at arts publications, you can look at this H factor that people have, or H index rather, and if you look at the H index versus the number of years that they've been publishing, there are very, very few people who have a ratio of greater than one for the H index. In soil science, for the people that I looked up anyway, that I could think to look up, I only found four people who have that. They're Rien van Gunnichten, Jurke Simonek, I've forgotten who the last one is. Where is he? Danny Orr, of course. Danny Orr and Jasper Vroet. So just to give you an idea, he's on the trajectory to follow in some really big footsteps. If you're not aware of his work, he works in inverse methods. He's done some revolutionary things. If you ever have need to use inverse models, look him up and follow him. You'll see him for many years to come. Jesper. Oh, I forgot to mention two other things. He's that are worthwhile. He's the Robert Oppenheimer Fellow at Los Alamos National Lab right now, and he's also just been awarded the Dutch Hydrology Prize.
This is the composition of the current committee that is changing for the next year because Cypher as chair is now stepping down. There is a new chair, which is Michael Young, and John Wright is also going out of the committee, and I'm replacing him as a chair, this year chair, and then we got David Robinson as also prior recipient of this award to join the committee. So. Okay, and now the business. I reorganized it slightly against what I gave you because Rien is leaving earlier, and so I moved the information about the Kirkham conference and Kirkham Medal up in that order. So I would like to ask Jan Hopmans, who is the chair of the Kirkham conference, to give you some information about that meeting.
All right, thank you. The Kirkham Conference is going to be held in February of coming year, 2008. The conference is funded by the Kirkham Endowment, and it's held every 4 years. And it can be held anywhere in the world. It was held before in the first time in Iowa, 3 years ago in Utah State, Logan. And the plan was to be held in Ghent, Belgium. I'm sorry. But because of financial complications and so on, we actually changed it. And since I'm the chair, I felt like the best place to go was Davis. So we'll have it in Davis. That sounds like, you know, an executive decision, and it was. But time was short, and you know I couldn't see how to do it differently. So that's what we decided to do. The main goal, and I want to give you some background. The main goal of the conference is to develop emerging soil physics, primarily through informal discussions with scientists outside the soil physics profession. So what we did is, so remember, so this conference is organized through the funds that are generated by the endowment. So every time, and we did this again this time, is we invited 10 speakers internationally from outside the soil physics community. Okay. Also, we sent out a call for graduate students and postdocs. We were fairly successful, I thought. So we did that in the summer or late summer. We got about 30 applications, and so we in the end awarded 12 of those to. And pay for the travel and so on, which is what we do for the invited speakers as well, okay, to come to the conference. Other participants to the conference, and I go through this over here because there are bylaws, and it explicitly states, you know, the scope and the intent and the participation of the conference, so you understand what we are doing. So other participants include all the Kirkham awards, like Jakob, the award that he received this year. I think we have now 10 of those. So all 10 of them were invited and pretty much are coming and participate in the Kirkham conference. And then there are what's called mid-career scientists. So these are, we identified a list of those. And the idea is for these people that they are active in the community and I can actually reach out to the other disciplines. Okay, so these are some criteria that we used, and in the end we had 10 or 12 or so that we send out invitations as well to participate. in the conference. So it's organized by committee, and it's the committee is I can give you the names of the committee. And by the way, there is a website. So for those of you interested in what's in the development and in the conference itself, there's a website, and you do Kirkham Conference Davis, and you will find it. Members are Brent Clothier, Danny Orr, Jerka Simonek, David Robinson, Marcus Tuller, and myself. So the six of us have been busy in the past half year or so to put this together. Now, indeed, this is a closed conference, and you know, and I know there is some anxiety, and it has been in the past. So that's why we proceed the way we have been proceeding. The idea is that it's that it really is open, and that everybody has an opportunity, a lot of discussion. However, I decided this year is to videotape it and have streaming video, and I'm planning is to make it available real time on the web, so that all invited talks will be available for everybody to view. What else? Are there any questions to this? So we tried, and you know, also what we tried to do is with this committee is to further develop it, and we'll see what happens this coming year and expand it. And so if we all feel very strongly that this is not the format, we should do it differently. I think there are ways, you know, we can do that. But of course, we don't want it to be a large workshop where we are having a few presentations, filled with presentations, and no discussion, because that would really be the wrong way of doing it. The other thing is that I want to emphasize is that the goal is to really is bring soul physics out to other related sciences, and so is to really integrate the science, the physics, with other sciences. Okay, thank you.
What will be done on this conference is that there will be a Kirkham Medal awarded, which I believe will be done at every other Kirkham conference, so every 8 years, right? And Rien has some information about this Kirkham Medal. And let me get you your presentation. So we have a Kirkham Award, which is really a mid-career award in the area of soul physics. So it's really two criteria. It's in the soul physics area and mid-career. And now the society also established a Kirkham Medal, which is to be awarded here. And this is the definition: every 8 years, alternate Kirkham conferences. So really, the criteria are: it's a career award, career achievements. It has to be in the area of soul physics. It relates to teaching, research, and professional activities. And the person has to be living and retired. So. We're talking about again the career achievements. It's a medal every 8 years, and so as the first committee was to look at the selection of this was established by the society, they asked me to chair it as the first Kirkham Award winner, and all the Kirkham Award winners up to date are members of this committee. The procedure is, as we discussed, would be to solicit nominations from everybody. We do not want really large write-ups. Some of the people that potentially could be awarded the Kirkham Medal, some of them are very old. We don't really want to bother them too much. Think about Arnold Kloot or their case on Bavel is on there. These are just suggestions. So what I will do is first of all, everybody in here, I know there are a number of names missing. We want to make sure that we don't forget anybody.
And so what I'm going to ask you is really reflect upon names that are not on this list that we should consider. We have quite a few are missing. I know some of them are actually in this room. So we want to make sure that there are no names missing. And then the procedure is as follows, where the committee looks at the names, we pare it down to about 15, and then we rank them. I'm going to send out an email to all the S1 members to provide additional names as they see fit that should be on the list. And so if you can think of names, it doesn't mean think of one name. You know, think of multiple names. We can have multiple nominations from one person that may think of names that probably should be included in this list. And the deadline is December 1. Steve. It's not in the text that I got. So there's no membership requirement. No. So send me an email. Look at the names a little bit. I'm sure there are a couple of missing. Certainly people that are missing. But send me an email if you think that there are certainly people that deserve consideration. You know, and then we start paring it down. Okay. Any other question? Thanks.
Okay, and the next item on the agenda is Visage Radio Zone Journal editorial report, and it's Jan Hoffman again.
All right, good news.
So the Radio Zone Journal is doing very well. We have really achieved two major goals this year, two major accomplishments, one of which is finally the impact factor came out. Everybody asking, what's the impact factor of Radio Zone Journal? Well, the verdict is out. It's 1.55. Round it off, okay? I believe we all think is very good. I mean, it's almost like above expectation. Also with that also came another criterion, which is called the immediacy factor, and the immediacy factor is the time, or that's some kind of a number that relates to the time the number of citations come out since first publication. And the immediacy factor of the Radio Zone Journal in the soil science theme is number one. So in other words, you know, citations from the journal are quick after publication of the journal. In terms of, you know, the ISI, they have these different groupings. They have soils grouping, water resources grouping. They also have environmental sciences grouping, and then they rank all the journals in each of these groupings. And in the soil science grouping, our journal is number 7. In the water resources, it's number 9. If you are familiar with these impact factors, 1.55. is very close, so we are competing. We're going to compete with Soil Science Society Journal. We're going to compete with Water Resources Research, and so on. We are very, you know, it doesn't take much to exceed. Now, whether that is so important or not, I don't think it is. But there are some institutions think it is very important. So we'll just have to keep up with it, and hopefully that is going to, you know, with this impact factor, we're going to get more submissions. The other important accomplishment is that Radio Zone Journal is in the black. Hey! Let's ring the bell. So, you know, at any meetings, and I actually, it's just a few that I went to and last year, it's, you know, there is no question within the society about whether we should continue with the Radio Zone Journal. Okay, so the Radio Zone Journal is a go. Let's see, what do I have written? Okay, now the question is, why is it in the black? First of all, the editorial office did an excellent job in actually redesigning the journal as they did with some of the other journals. So basically, if you're familiar with it, the font size, the layout, and altogether, it actually reduced the number of pages and cost associated with publishing per manuscript. The other reason you think would be subscriptions, and actually that's where I need your help, still. As we do every year, is the number of subscriptions have not changed really. It's stagnant. I think it's stagnant. I mean, the number has been, you know, the same for the past three years or so. Mostly institutional subscriptions. There are some personal ones, but not too many. You know, we need to increase these subscriptions because that's really what's a major part of the income of the journal. The Vedasun journal is highly visible and used, and they keep a record in terms of how many hits, how many PDFs are uploaded or downloaded, downloaded from the website. And just in the past year, the number of PDFs downloads has been tripled. So wins went from 10,000 to 15,000 to 45,000. Okay, so it's an amazing number of people that are actually looking into the journal. Everybody knows about it. They're still debating whether they want to submit or not, but it's certainly there. The pace charges have changed. This has been in debate for at least a year, if not 2 years, in terms of what to do if you... The pace charge before until the end of this year has been a fixed pace charge. So whatever the length of the manuscript, it would cost you $650, which is a ridiculous pace charge. So then we all realized that, and so now we went to a per-page pay charge. The question then is, how much would you charge? And so the number has been $80 per page, which is kind of high, but that's what we feel, but that's what they settled on. And that number can change. I mean, if it seems like we're doing very well with that number, the intent would certainly be to decrease it. So. But I guess I'm sure we would still want to continue to be in the black. So I don't know how much flexibility there is. The number of submissions of the journal has also been kind of quite steady. If I go back 3-4 years, it was 150. It's been 170 last year, went 180, 185, and right now I was hoping we would hit the 200, but we haven't. And then again, I need your help, and let me explain why. When the journal started, what was it, 5 years ago or so, Reen, he just left. He had to catch his plane, but of course he did a tremendous job in getting the journal off the ground, and he asked all of us to submit to the journal, which we did. And that was part of the reason why it took off as it did. But then, we actually achieved the goal that others would submit to the journal, and actually right now we have about certainly 2/3, if not more, of the authors are from outside the society. So we achieved that goal. However, what we're seeing is a decline of submissions from our own. And Glenn, the Soul Science Society journal is doing extremely well. I at least it did last year. I don't know what the numbers are this year, but I would imagine it's about the same. So I would like to make a plea is to not forget the Vedasun journal. Now it's going quite well, but it's still a society journal and it came from us, and we want to make sure that it keeps on going well and straightforward, move forward and so on. And so we think about submitting papers, we certainly welcome your papers. Not only in S1, but also in other divisions, because all this is all related to Vedasun. So it's not only, I'm sorry, Glenn, not only Soul Science Society Journal, but we also need to keep in mind the Vedasun Journal, if we. Okay, what else do I have? Oh, the editorial board. So Reen retired last year. I think it was already announced last year, but we needed to find a replacement, and we did. We found Susan Hubbard at Lawrence Berkeley Lab to join the editorial board as co-editor. And so she's been on the board since the summer or so. And so clearly, the reason she was attracted was because she was also outside the society, and again would very clearly indicate to the community that we are a journal that has its breadth, and we are looking for submissions. In the other disciplines, like in this case, hydrology and geophysics. The other little note I have is open access. Some of you might have already done this. Open Act, you know, right now, as you publish in the journal and many other journals, it's kind of, you need to subscribe or you have to pay for an article in order to have access to it. Some journals have what's called open access, so you can actually pay a fee as an author. And so you pay a certain amount, and then that article will be available, freely available to everybody. And that fee would offset subscription rates, I believe. That fee has been established to be $800. So as an author, if you would like your article to be available for in the community, you would then have an option to pay $800. We recommended that to the board that we will do that for this journal. I don't know what the outcome, whether that has been decided yet. We did, so we met yesterday and made the recommendation. Oh, that will be tomorrow? Okay. So we would like to give the authors the option to for that, okay, for an open access.
So that'd be 650,
800.
80 per page plus 800.
Right, so you keep on paying the pay share. So, it's all the journals, they actually... That's a normal amount. I mean, if you go to other journals, they actually, it's likely more than that. I know I did it once and it cost me $1,000, and others is $1,200, $1,500. So if you look at all the journals, it's not that steep. But to me, it's for our journal, it seems to be steep. Steve. That's the average, yeah. Yes, right. That will be $1,600. Right. And then anybody can click on it and can download it. I'm sorry? No. If you really want to, what I'm saying is, it's a vote on what? It's an option that you have as an author. So you don't have to do this at all, right? I mean, you just don't check the box and nothing has changed. But if you would like to have it open access, then you check the box, and as you pay pay charges, that will be added to it, and then you pay for it. So it's just an option. It's a service to the community. If they want to do it, they can do it. So there is no negative side to it.
I disagree.
I'd like to hear what the negative. Go ahead. Can you? Because we are wondering what the negative. There are journals that have open access for Mitch Lass? Well, I think we would like to hear that, because we will be interested to find out. Danny? Thank you, Jerka. That's the argument that is made. I mean, somebody has to pay for it. And
I think it's important that Beta Sun Journal stay in the black. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to do anything that kind of goes back and...
Exactly. We don't want to go... We want to stay in the black. Now, but I agreed, and so the editorial staff agrees that they are not clear exactly what the amount would be. They basically go by, what are typical charges elsewhere. they would like to evaluate the impact, if there's any impact, and then adjust the amount. We've 420 or so in total. And Dan?
If I were not subscribing and I wanted to download an article, what does it cost me now?
What is it per page? Who knows? Is it $30, $40, something like that? I should know. I think so. And so that's income to the...
Right, well, I understand that part, but I was trying to get perspective. It's not about $800, that says 20 downloads for that paper. I'm just wondering if you couldn't grant the sliding scale, if I wanted to provide 53 copies of my paper, I'd pay for that.
Right, okay, you can look at it that way, as an author.
Yeah,
as an author. So if you say, well, I want to make it available, I pay, so, you know, I pay up front. Yeah, I think I understand where you're coming from. I'm not sure where the dollar amount.
I don't know either.
Okay. Jakob. So, I don't think we should worry too much about it. I think I, it's an option. It's a service we want to provide to the authors. But at the same time, I kind of agree. You want to make sure that it is an option, that it is a service, and not a disservice to the journal. So if you make it very high, then from the outside you can say, well, forget it. I'm not going to even, this journal is trying to make a profit, which of course it's not. I mean, it's just trying to be in the black at this point. Well, that's a good question. I think if I remember, and there's a lot of discussion about this, of course, a lot of the national the funding agencies, I mean, that's basically already tax dollars, so they want the research product to be freely available because they already paid for it, right? So, and some of these agencies, and I know NIH is used as an example every time, and they would require that in fact the papers will be freely available, but then there's a timeline associated with that too. They understand that there is a period. 18? No, I think it's shorter for like NIH, what they require.
Yeah.
So whether the general agencies would accept that, I would think so. All right, we need to move on, says Danny. So again, I want to thank everybody for continuing to support this journal. But submit, okay? I like to see some more submissions from our own community. That would be great. Okay. So Danny wants to, he wants to make one point, and actually, one of the things that he decided to do.
Submission to He's preaching to the choir. We already love the journal. I'll give the SSAJ report. SSAJ is still doing real well. The number of manuscripts submitted, 424, is just a little bit less than last year, but still about 10% above the previous 3 years. S1 last year had a banner year, had 110 submissions. We a little bit lower than that, 91, but still doing well above what we had done in those previous 3 years. And so, you know, again, to support what Jan was saying, one of the concerns was, well, FSJ was going to hurt S1, and it certainly has not done that. We are doing very, very well. Impact factors doing real well. We're fifth in the new category of soil science. We were third last year, but first in total citations, citation half-life, various other categories. The journal's doing real well. A couple of announcement retiring from the board. We're losing three people this year: Li Wang Mao, Yakov Bishevsky, and La Xing Wu. Each of them served 6 years. And they're going to be very difficult to replace because those were three outstanding associate editors. So we've got three new ones coming on, and they've got quite a job ahead of them to fill in those shoes. And that's going to be Tai Furi, Kasuka Naburi, and Ole Windorf. So looking forward to working with them. Just the new initiatives, you can see it here is the same issue that we just got through talking about. The one thing different on the open access was SSAJ didn't say that they support the $800 fee. Get to what Stephen you were saying. I didn't like the $800 fee, but headquarters is real strong about that. So what we proposed was for a fee to be determined by the society. And we felt like that'll go back to the board, and the board will look into it and address what the fee should be. The other thing that we did this year was decided to form a committee to develop the criteria for an outstanding paper, something that gets to really encouraging publishing outstanding papers and factors that are going to impact this impact factor. So that should be coming to as a proposal to the board next year. Right now we're looking at what criteria to use, how it should be selected, and have this outstanding paper. The other thing to announce is a few years ago, just a couple of years ago, the journal decided to start having these encouraging multidisciplinary papers, and the way that it looked at doing that was having special topics, and it chosen two special topics, landscape management and urban soils. We've had a few publications in that area, but not many. And they don't get reviewed very well, and there's some reasons for that. And but their acceptance rates are really pretty low, and so the journal has decided we're doing away with the special topics. And what we did anyway when we got a special topics was we found a division that they fit into and forced them into a division kind of anyway for the review process. And we felt like that was in some ways possibly hurting their publication. So at the end of this calendar year, that'll be the last time that we will accept these special topics. With that, I made it as quick as I could.
Okay, thank you.
Unless you have questions.
Conference call, and when we have a meeting, everybody has to show up, and a lot of work gets done.
Okay, thank you. Any comments? Yeah.
On that line, you know, I've been trying to do a joint session together with you. It's December, but you gave you a whole time. And that was kind of like an individual effort. I was trying to see if I can help as possible. And I found it as long as possible. But I thought, you know, I think we sent an email out to the S1 that could submit to ADU. But then I found out if you could be a member of ADU or if you could be a member of my sponsor. Yeah, this is not, it's not the optimal situation. But anyway, this is fashion. There's so much to control of hydrology, I think they call it. And we have about 30 or 35 submissions, so we did have two sessions. But, you know, so I think, so I want to team up with you and see what we can, if it's more broad than the TSA, maybe we can go looking for it.
Yeah, I think if you, and many of us, including you already, I think Mark, you were just directed to the PSA, but just from what I have seen so far, they don't have the membership requirements, certainly that you can do special sessions for the PSA. In some ways, you know, having a separate joint meeting would be very nice, because there's a whole lot of complications in finding it.
Yes.
What's going to be the process of trying to get joint meeting with GSA
administration? That probably you could answer that, right? Because there was a planning committee yesterday about it. So do you have some information? There'll be something be special. I just understand that the dates are moved, right? And
yeah, we had the 2008 planning meeting last evening. And if you take the last page of your annual program, you can see it's a joint meeting with the Geological Society of America and Gulf Coast Association of Geological Societies, meaning that instead of maybe 4,000 plus, there'll be between 10 and 12,000 for the meeting, so it's big. A planning committee has decided on I think 10 overarching teams that could kind of join together sessions, special symposia for the meetings. And I think we in S1, we have a pretty good possibility of an impact here. So I've talked to a few people about maybe making something of interest for both the soil physics and the GSA. But it'll be fast track planning. Note the dates. The meetings will be October 5 to 9. It's pushed forward a lot. Originally, the meetings were planned for Chicago, but there was a double booking. Now we are in this big meeting in Houston. It's exciting. It's a big possibility, but it's also early, so I could feel attention last evening. This is fast track planning. So we all need to be on our toes for next year. Preliminary titles for special symposia, preferable, some that can kind of overarch between the three participating societies, are due December 4th, meaning that if you have good ideas, please contact me very soon. I have talked to quite a few people here and also did last evening, but I would very much welcome good suggestions for symposia. We'll have probably two one-day special symposia in S1. That is kind of the recommendation. And then, of course, there'll be the sessions. But again, we are still free to plan as we want. This is not limitations. This is opportunities to make something that has a bigger outreach. And we can have maybe some sessions attracting a lot more people, making S1 visual in a quite extraordinary way, I think. So please, again, at the poster session, maybe now and also after that, email me with good suggestions. I have already contacted a few of you. Those would be the kind of corresponding session chairs. Yes, I have a list. And two or three of them are highly relevant, of course, for soil physics. Yes. Yeah. Right. And, yeah. Yeah, sure. I'll do that immediately. We talked about it last evening, and it was, I could see for most of the Tri-Society session chairs, this was new. But we are ready to go, and we took a long time discussing what we could do and said this is the way to do. We need to contact our opposing session chairs and get going there and see if we can get the ideas flowing. Yes?
I think that's right.
Yeah, you're right, there were some negative voices the last evening too, but again, I don't think we are in any way limited. It's just new opportunities to do some exciting stuff, bigger symposia and so on.
Tri-societies,
yeah. Yeah. I heard that crops and rocks are not so, and so yeah.
Thank you. Okay, well, the next item is the program report. So we had a tremendous growth against the last year. Last year we had 103 volunteer papers. This year we had 169, so that's 60% growth. So if Bear is going to keep it up, then it's going to be 260 next year. It's partly probably because we organized two symposia which attracted people from other divisions, probably, especially the first symposia, which was co-sponsored by three other divisions. I would like to thank David Robinson, Ty Ferrey, and Binayak Mohanty, who put a lot of effort in that, with help of others probably also. As you can see, we are the fourth highest division in SSSA, behind S3, S6, and S11. And every division was limited to have two symposia, so these are the two symposia we had, and then they both are already finished. Okay, so if there are any announcements, that's the next item, and I heard that so somebody, you want to make an announcement, or? More or less, yeah. This is what, well, that I just have here what's on the program.
Well, I just have a quick announcement for the Drupal SJ associate editors for the afterwards that we went out to dinner. I learned from BCJ that I should be there. That's not. The
Is there any other business you want to discuss or make any other announcements? So if that's not so, then you can go from here to ASA award reception. You can go to our poster. So we have another poster session right now between 4 and 6. And tomorrow we have two sessions, one which is organized by our group and another one which we co-sponsor with AO3, with Pete Everett. And then this is just the information about the future meeting. So next one is in Houston, that's the joint meeting. Then it's Pittsburgh, Long Beach, and San Antonio. And that's all I have. And now I will just transfer all the authority I have, if I have any, to Per Muldrow.
Well, thank you. First, join me in saying thank you to Jirka.